Alright, so our agenda is here. Today on the agenda, we are reconsidering the prefix-suffix separator, talking about a JSON-LD grammar or formalizing the JSON-LD grammar in some way, allowing terms to expand to multiple IRIs, and then supporting something like a context in the coercion rules, or basically a way of doing a context-based term, for lack of a better way of saying that. So basically being able to say that name means two different things depending on where it's used in the JSON-LD document. Anything else to add to the agenda? Anything to discuss? I do have one thing.
I went to Stanford last week and gave a presentation on JSON-LD to the it was the bioinformatics group, but it also includes the Protégé developers. And at least within the bioinformatics group, there's strong use on intention to use JSON-LD for their sort of ontology mapping tools.
Cool.
Yeah.
So let's kind of discuss that really quickly. So JSON-LD for bioinformatics. I guess bioinformatics.
It's biomedical informatics is the particular department, but I think there's just a lot of ontology work there, sort of surrounding the Protégé. A lot of work around that. So they have some work trying to map together multiple ontologies and try to make sense of them, a lot of which has to do with dealing with different format differences. But as these are, these applications make a lot of use of HTML applications, JSON is such a natural representation for them.
Wait, did you say make use of a lot of HTML or like web pages than JSON makes? Like, is JSON-LD being used as kind of a data backhaul here, or?
My understanding is it's sort of to support the sort of RESTful APIs in HTML-based user interfaces.
Okay. Okay, cool. Well, I mean, that's certainly exactly what we're using it for at our company. Were there any questions on features that they needed, or were they just kind of dipping their toes into it now?
I think the main one that keeps coming up is sort of ID mapping, where you have something that needs to be in a different form than is stated. And wanting to do some form of a macro processing on it in order to get it into a different format.
Okay. And right now the biggest, seems like the best solution for that might be using graph with an object instead of an array, maybe? What you proposed last week, Greg?
No, it wasn't so much in terms of the using objects to map IDs. It's that the IDs themselves need to be modified somewhat to create a URI.
Template-based.
Some template-type mechanism.
Yeah. I really think that we should take another look at that and see. I mean, if we use the simplest form of key expansion declarations, that should cover the things we've seen so far. But, of course.
Right. Do we have an issue for that? I don't think we have an issue for this.
I think we closed it.
Well, we decided not to do it, right? Because we were like, well, they can just leave the ID blank and set the their own internal ID as something else.
Yeah.
The use case is a bit strange, at least to me, because it seems like, I guess I don't understand why they need the ID generated in a particular way, because they don't have, it's not dereferenceable, right? They don't have these URLs lying around. So, or I'm also wondering why it can't be like a post-processing step that they do.
Those are all things that I mentioned. I believe that they probably can be dereferenceable, but the identifier, they want something that does it from the identifier that they're using. So,
I think it's a bit of a teaching issue combined with the notion of linked data and the dereferenceability and basically the Hato's principle in REST as well, that I think we should consider if we go down this path, because for one, I think the teaching issue is that people tend to conflate what we mean by ID with what they use as an internal ID. We use the notion of the IRI as the public dereferenceable identifier, and that's for connecting your data with other things, whereas the regular use of ID is just the internal counter or whatever the system they're using is based on. And most local systems use this ID in various contexts to map to certain web views or to reference things within the data. And at least in the latter part, it's really dangerous to conflate them, because then you don't link by IRI anymore. You just associate, just like with any relational database.
Right.
So there are things here to be very explicit about, I think. But I mean, to some extent, being able to declare the way to construct an IRI from the canonical identifier within your data, within your context, seems fairly beneficial as well.
I guess another approach is we could provide an API method that says whenever you see this, you know, key, or whenever you see this term, then change the ID to this pattern. So that might be an alternative. Instead of changing the syntax or changing the processing rules, just adding an API method for these people.
I think that's a bit dangerous though, because that would hide the mapping from the data to the IRI, which sort of takes away the LD part.
What you're saying, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, then, do we need to open 108 back up? Then, does this require any more discussion? Greg, was this like a blocker for them, or?
No, it wasn't a blocker. If we're going to do something, we probably want to look at the RFC 6570, which relates to URI templates, and try to see if there's some way to incorporate what we do, so we're not sort of inventing a lot of new syntax.
Right. Yeah. Let's see if I can find the reference to. I have a sort of temporarily shelved project called COIN, standing for the Composition of Identifier Names, which is a vocabulary combined with URI templates to be able to define how to create IRIs from parts of the data of the descriptions of your resources. And I used that in the legal information project I worked on, because we had very strange legacy forms of expressions which we had to generate identifiers for, and we needed to keep the URI space manageable even for these odd forms. So I had to declare, I began with procedural mapping in code, and then I started to declare these definitions in just raw JSON, and then I realized that I should probably just define the vocabulary and see if others are interested in it as well. And I will hopefully pick this up to formalize it even more. I began writing a spec for it, but I had some people interested in it. Richard Zaganiak also felt that it was a good thing to have, but he didn't have the time to participate at the time. But the relation to this is that in this, I've seen that it's not always as simple as just picking the one key from your data. It's often a combination of keys, and sometimes there are three keys or two keys and the different URIs. It very much depends on the nature of the old ways you've published the data. So it might be tricky and complex if we open up that path.
Yeah. I mean, my personal preference is to not necessarily reopen this until we get someone that says it's a blocker, because it seems like people should be able to generate their own IDs if they need to. I mean, it seems, you know, basically our response can be, well, are you positive, you know, if you're going to generate an ID, is this data going to be dereferenceable at that ID? Because if it's not, then you probably shouldn't be generating an ID for it. And then the follow-up is, you know, if you do need to keep that ID around, you can just put it in, you know, something, another type of term, like, you know, like Music Brain's identifier, MBID. You can use that. And then if they need to, if they really, really need to generate a proper ID, it doesn't seem like it would be a large amount of code for them to just take the, like, something like the Music Brain's ID and then generate a URL for it. I guess if we try and formalize this at this stage, I'm concerned that we don't have enough examples of how people would use this kind of IRI templating, you know, language in JSON-LD to generate IRIs. I'm afraid that we'd formalize something that doesn't work for, you know, it works for a couple of simple cases, but it turns out that many people have complex cases and it doesn't work for them.
Yeah. I think that's true. And although it's tempting if you look at the Music Brain's data to, my first response was, well, why don't you just put the links in the object? That's valuable, and then you have different properties for the various kinds of links that I represent. One is the home page, one is described by data page, and the third is the object itself. Of course, then the second response would be, well, these are very uniform and we would save a lot of bandwidth and general energy in publishing this if we could extract this generalized pattern into a templating mechanism. Mm-hmm. But even at that stage, we've seen that, well, the different IRIs represent different relations and different things, so that's probably where the thing ends up being too much complexity to be worth it.
Now, the other area that came up is the use of URNs as as sort of an identifier space, and the lack of a base keyword sort of prevents us from being able to use relative URIs to create URNs, you can do for URIs. So there was also some discussion of whether a base might be something that we should consider adding back into JSON-LD.
Yeah, that's true. I think that something like that popped up in my mind as well. Either that or declaring some other prefix for that defeats the purpose. Well, you could define terms for the ID itself. I mean, you could say that just bind the key representing the ID to the IRI being the proper IRI, and then use that opaque value as the value for the at ID property.
Yeah,
but that's just cheating, really. But if you really, really want that shape of the data, you can do it by pushing all the IDs into the context.
That's true.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Anything else on this before we move on? So Greg, is it fair to say that there's nothing very pressing that we should put into the issue tracker?
Well, I think what we should do, or what I'll do, is I will update the issue on that with a reference to the minutes from today so that we can track the discussions.
Okay, sounds good. Let's see. So on to our agenda. Oh, actually, before we go to our agenda, let's hope. I'm trying to make sure that we don't have another day where we don't get around to our agenda. Let's talk about the JSON-LD first public working drafts. Greg, would you mind scribing today?
Sure.
So the JSON-LD first public working drafts went out. Great job, guys. That's fantastic news. I think that we were unsure when we started the JSON-LD work in the community group how exactly this would pan out, and there was a decent amount of concern and worry that we would hit a brick wall when we hit this stage, but everything seems to be going along smoothly. The RDF working group and their chairs are very committed to getting a JSON-LD rec out, and certainly it would not have been possible without all of the really hard work that each of you have put in. And in an unfortunate publishing error on my part, I forgot to include Nicholas's name on the first public working draft, which is awful. And so it's on there now, and I'm trying to get it cleared with W3C to try and update the first public working draft so Nicholas's name ends up there. I mean, certainly it should be on that draft. And sorry, Nicholas, that was a bad oversight on my part.
Don't worry about it. It would be funny if they could do it, but it's more in general interesting if it's possible to do it, just to see how the process works. These things will be updated anyways.
You certainly get into the next working draft that goes out. That might be a bit before that happens, I suppose.
Yeah. In any case, I'm asking for just two words to be added to the spec, Nicholas's name, so first and last name, so hopefully that won't be too much. It doesn't change any of the intellectual property concerns around it, so shouldn't be difficult
to do.
Okay, well, you know, it's not difficult to do. We'll see if there's some W3C process that prevents it from happening. Okay. Anything on the the other thing that I wanted to mention is that during the RDF working group call last week, there was concern about the way that we're accepting changes into the spec. So right now, the JSON-LD syntax and the API are under the purview of the RDF working group, which basically means that the JSON-LD, LD group, this community group, is not editing those specs anymore. Now, from a practical standpoint, what that means is that we cannot accept pull requests for the specs from anybody that is not in the RDF working group anymore. So a number of us have commit rights to the repo. Make absolutely sure that if you accept the pull request, it is coming from an RDF working group member. So we can't pull in any changes from anybody other than those people right now. We're trying to figure out a way to make that happen, but it's fairly complicated, mainly because you need the people that do the pull request to sign off on something to say that they're giving up their copyright or they're licensing their text to be used in the specifications. Now, what we can do as an alternate is if somebody puts in a patch request, what we need to do as editors and authors is basically just go in and edit the document and add what they asked to have added, but do not copy and paste their text. Put it in your own words and modify the spec in that way. Now, one of the strange side effects from this is that since Dave Lane and Dave Longley are not in the RDF working group, they are not allowed to edit those specs anymore. And the likelihood that they're going to be able to get into the RDF working group is very low, since we are not, my company is not an RDF working group, it's not a W3C member company. So in a twist of irony, some of the main contributors to the technology are not able to edit the spec any longer.
This is interesting. I mean, neither am I at the moment, because I'm still, I think that the guy at 6, I've been waiting for a response from, is that he's on vacation. So.
Okay. So that's important. Don't commit anything to the specs until you're an RDF working group member.
Absolutely not.
It's not a terrible thing if something accidentally sneaks in, but at that point we need them to formally write something to the W3C saying that they license it. It's just a pain. Okay. So is that clear? No edits to the syntax of the API document from anyone other than the editors at this point? And then you can do pull requests from RDF working group members, but I doubt any of those are going to come in. So,
Juana, was there also some discussion over how much discussion needs to take place on RDF comments?
They said, from my recollection, well, you can send the change request into RDF comments. So if somebody does a pull request, we basically reject the pull request and tell them to send their comment into RDF comments, and we will apply it to the document. But the legality, I mean, so I didn't want to really raise it on the telecon at that point, but the legality of that's still fairly, it's no different as, it's ultimately, I believe it's no different than making a pull request. Especially if there's a license, you know, there's a commit license that's clear in the spec. Basically, you know, I mean, it works for GPL, and I know that Andy was asserting that, well, you know, this is a different type of copyright. It's not GPL, so it doesn't work the same way. I don't agree with that. But having that disagreement and argument on the RDF working group mailing list is not, I don't think it would be a very productive use of our time. So basically, if someone makes a pull request, reject it and tell them to send it to RDF comments, because that is a path that W3C has been using for a very long time. Just to be very, very clear,
when they sign up to be able to submit to RDF comments, they've signed some form of a license that allows anything that they send to that list to be used. And that was sort of the reasoning behind that.
Yeah, and I don't remember getting anything like that for RDF comments. It might be because I joined as an RDF working group member, and that's automatically done. Have any of you subscribed to RDF comments?
Yes, I did.
When I did, I think there was something like that. I don't recall specifically, but
that's clear. Legally, that's clear then. Basically, and it, just to be very, very clear, do not accept any, if someone sends a patch into RDF comments, do not apply it, because Andy was kind of concerned about that. It's not clear whether your agreement that anything that you send to RDF comments can be used applies to patch requests. I think is it pretty clear? Basically, I mean, hopefully the only people that should be editing these documents from now on out are the editors, and hopefully we'll figure out something with W3C, but we're not holding our breath on that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wonder
any questions
if,
and concerns with this? Go ahead, Michael, sorry.
It's sad to see the that two of you guys can't contribute, as you said, Dave and Len and Longley, because I mean it's kind of like the situation I've had, but even worse. I wonder if this should somehow, if we could do something or discuss this somehow with the W3C to discuss the way that contributing works. I mean, I do understand that they have to have paying member organizations, but somehow being able to work as a contractor to another member might be a feasible way. I'm trying to do that now, but there are no
right.
formal mechanisms for it, and I think that it
yeah.
could be beneficial for them to. I mean, it's as it is right now. I mean, I take time off to do stuff sometimes, and I mean, I can't really motivate my company to pay a lot of money to do that.
Right.
Yeah. No. I completely understand your position, and it's kind of like ours. It's, you know, we're already
yeah.
putting in a ton of sweat equity basically into these specs and, you know, doing implementations and all of that kind of stuff, and, you know, other people are benefiting from that. It's not in the valuation of our participation, right? So right now the value of our participation in W3C is $0 per the
yeah.
current way that, you know, they calculate it.
So,
Mara, really
I don't know, have you actually tried to see, because I know they have variable...
We have
right.
it's yeah, and we're looking at that as a you know, we can join the W3C if we you know, spend like $2,500, but our board is not convinced why we need to pay them money when we're also investing all this money in the specs that they get to put their name on. So our board's
well,
a bit, you know, we're in a bad position in that.
W3C is hardly an outlier in this regard, and, you know, of course they do have, there are costs with running such an organization. So
true,
it's great that if, of course, members are expected to volunteer time for it. Pacewarm,
mm-hmm.
I think, has gone above and beyond,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion, and perhaps, but you know, in my opinion, I think $2,500 a year seems already pretty nominal. So.
Yeah, no, that's true. It's just we do not make that much. I mean, it's the decision
yeah.
with us is the choice between daycare for our kids and spending money at the W3C. That's really the decision on the table. So, you know, it's
yeah.
difficult for us to.
Now, did you actually pursue getting IE status for Lane and Longley?
No, we haven't done that, and it's, again, it's, you know, we hate to ask for that because we know that W3C is already, you know, allowing us to participate as IEs in a variety of different things. So it's just it's a weird balance where it's a delicate balance that we're not trying to, you know, pitch too much. In any case, we're having discussions with the W3C, and we'll see where those go. If Longley and Lane can't commit stuff to the spec, it's not the end of the world, because the spec already has multiple editors, and you know, it's not going to hold us up. And you know, we like David Wood said last week, we can continue to talk about this stuff on this call. That's not a, there's no thought police preventing Longley and Lane from participating. So we'll get something worked out. We always do. We'll figure it out. So either you know, they become members, either we become members, which would be the clearest path, or they become invited experts, which is a bit shaky, or things remain as they are and they can't edit the specs. So.
Well, one thing is, it just seems like you know, me and Dave are just we're one part of the problem, but you know, we really need to figure out how to do this for other people who happen to like come across the GitHub repo and find a typo and have a pull request.
Yeah, no, that's very true.
Deal with that, and you know, it seems so silly to like rewrite a pull request to, you know, change a typo, and you know, all you really need to do is click the, you know, GitHub as a release, just click accept and
yeah.
it works. You know?
Yeah, I totally agree.
Is there a limit for like just typos and things versus like actual real content, or do they have, you know, just everything has to fall into the?
It's gray area when it comes to copyright.
Right.
You know, fixing a typo shouldn't matter. You can't, you know, you can't claim copyright on fixing a typo or a patch request like that.
Well, I've seen people submit typos over Twitter, you know, when they're having
right.
conversations. And so I think a certain amount of common sense is probably...
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
order. I mean, no court would uphold that. No court would say, oh, well, you know, that those three letters are the ownership, you know, are under the ownership of the person that submitted it over Twitter. Therefore, you are barred from, you know, publishing this work because of three letters. That just doesn't, would not happen in a court of law.
And I also don't think the intention is not to deal with typos. It's to deal with the substantive changes. So if someone has some thought, for instance, on the ultimate way of dealing with IRI templating, and they send in something that's either a sort of algorithmic language or code or something like that, that would be an area where it would need to have some clearer IPR.
Right. Yep. Okay. Well, in any case, we're working on this. I'm going to talk with Ian Jacobs at W3C to see if there's a clear way out of this.
Was there any difference? I think you discussed changing the message that people have to agree to at the start of this call.
They basically said that if it's not on record at W3C, it's problematic, and that wouldn't be, you know, like whenever we publish these recordings, it's not in the recordings that we publish. And the other, I guess, concern is that you need something on record. Someone needs to click a license, and it needs to be through W3C, and they need to verify that your email address is yours and a variety of those things. So I don't think there's anything that we can do on the call, really, to fix that. And that doesn't mean that we have to boot people off the call, but we need to be careful. When new people join the call, we need to be careful about, like David Wood said, there's no thought police. We can't prevent people from talking. But if for whatever reason something comes up that's a new, you know, innovation or whatever, we need to be careful with it on the call. And there's currently no process for that. So again, that's something I need to talk about with Ian Jacobs, see if there's any way that we can clear that for community groups. All right. Any questions on this before we move on? Comments on it?
But for us, like as the editors, the process is still the same, so we can just go and commit to GitHub, right?
Yep, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Okay.
So it shouldn't slow the editors down at all.
Okay.
Okay. First up is issue 132, reconsidering the prefix-suffix separator. We've got, let me get the link to that issue here. So this is something that Marcus raised. Marcus, would you like to give an intro to this issue?
Well, basically it's just about reconsidering whether we use the colon as a separator of prefix and suffix in a compact IRI, or whether we choose another character which would allow to access it in various programming languages directly without having to escape it or to enclose it in quotes. Because I think in a lot of cases people don't like to use prefixes because then they can't just use the dot notation, for example, in JavaScript anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, since the adoption of JSON-LD is not that big yet, it would still be possible to change it, but if we don't change it now, we won't be able to change it later on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we should at least briefly discuss whether we should, well, do it or not.
Right. So I certainly agree with you that using dot operators is preferred, certainly, to anything else. What we ended up doing with a lot of the Paceworm specs is we were using colon separators for a long time, and people really didn't like it. In fact, you know, it was one of those issues that people had with Paceworm that was really just a syntax issue with JSON-LD. So we decided to basically turn everything into a term, and that seems to, at least everything that could be accessed via dot notation, we change to a term. So, for example, like instead of doing like the, we have a security vocabulary and a public key URL. So, instead of this, we now do this. Dave Lane's right. Our context has become pretty big because of it. But that's, you know, cached, and actually working with the data in that term-based mechanism is much, much nicer than using the prefixes. As to what we could change it to, underscore and double underscore are problematic because, like MongoDB, I think is double underscore in certain places, and we've seen underscores in vocabulary terms quite often. So that's, I guess you'd only split on the first underscore, but that's still a bit concerning. Dollar sign seems to be used a lot more in JavaScript, but again, as Francois said, in the issue, it's still a bit confusing when you look at the code. It looks like some strange kind of, you know, operator. My preference is to not change it to something else.
I think when we reintroduced vocab, I think we accepted that, didn't we? That sort of ameliorates a lot of the needs for using compact IRIs.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Maybe. I mean, the thing is that when you start mixing vocabularies, it's an issue again. But even when, we've been writing some decent bit of JavaScript code for the Paceworm stuff, and every now and then we need to create an at context or reference it. And using the square operators for doing that is slightly annoying, but it's not terrible. Granted, having to do it all over the code would kind of suck, but if we have vocab in there, then we don't really have to do that. Nicholas, you're on the queue.
Yeah, I think that I generally agree that we should use terms in the context to handle these issues, because I have had thoughts about using prefix with another keyword as well in various scenarios early on, and even in Glue and things like that, and I've come to see that as, well, if I'm not actually defining the term within the context, I'm probably trying to mix too much, and that's, well, the idea of a context is that it's not a general thing, but that it's a very specific piece of data, and if I have an enormous amount of data there, either I want to just publish everything I've got, and for that, the explicit use of prefixes and QRIs or even IRIs is preferable, because the data which is not intended to be used within the domain of interest is annotational data. And for that, I think that the explicit need to use brackets and the QRI notation is a way to signal that this is annotational data, this is auxiliary data, and not intended to be a primary piece of information for this specific data. I mean, this, I can certainly imagine situations when that's not the case, but in general, I think that using terms to define your context is the way to go. I'd rather say terms or full IRIs, I think, than anything else to make it clear. I think that QRIs are a pragmatic tool to mix a lot of things within a data set, and you don't really know how it's going to be consumed, so you put it in there, and QRI is a way to make it as compact as possible. But I think that that's just to pack as much data as possible into the object being described, rather than having it as a primary mechanism for people to use when they consume your data. It's more for the advanced cases and for annotations. That said, that applies regardless of if you use prefixes as a colon or if we allow something which is workable in JavaScript, like dollar or underscore. Because we still use prefixes there, so it kind of gets unwieldy anyway, given that you don't have full control over it. But if the issue crops up at general intervals for others, I wouldn't mind allowing a mechanism to be defined to, within a context, define an alias for the colon, like dollar or underscore. But I wouldn't want to switch to it in the spec. I'd rather have it as an optional alias.
Greg, you're on the queue.
Yeah, I think in my case, I'm working quite a lot with my own vocabulary, which works off of schema.org. So when I'm using schema terms, there's really quite a number of it. But programmatically, when I'm actually trying to, when I'm writing code to access elements from objects, I know what I want to access, obviously, because I'm writing the code. So I have a need, for instance, for I end up aliasing ID and type, so that they can be used more directly in Backbone. There's certain things that I expect every object to have, such as a name, a description, or in the case of dealing with OWL ontologies, I really know I want to access, say, range and subtype of, things such as that. So for those cases, when I really know what I want to access, then I define terms to make it easy. It's for the cases where my logic is not built to access things that may occur in there that it just doesn't seem necessary to me to be able to. I couldn't use dot notation because my logic doesn't anticipate the need for these things specifically, and generically, the angle bracket notation is adequate to get to things that I've, say, determined through an inference in my code logic. So I don't really see a need to be more explicit in allowing the dot notation for things that aren't already built into my code.
Right.
Yeah, that's I agree with that sentiment.
The other, I guess, the other issue that I have with the dollar sign is that it can be confused with jQuery if you are quickly scanning through the code. It's a tiny, tiny issue, but it really sounds like we're leaning towards not modifying the colon for all of the reasons, all of the good reasons I feel that Nicholas and Greg kind of outlined. Marcus, is this something that's acceptable to you, or do you feel that those arguments were compelling, or are you still concerned about this?
Well, it's not. I mean, yeah, I agree with the arguments, but it's more about why people are using vocab, or why they are always asking for vocab or such mechanisms. But I think the reason for that is not that vocab was missing for some time in the spec, but because prefixes, they are, well, you lose a lot of convenience if you introduce that colon there. And on the other hand, people don't want to end up with large contexts.
But I don't see how this would make the need for vocab go away, because I think that the specific difference between this and vocab is that with vocab you use the terms from the vocabulary as is. If we supported this mechanism, you couldn't do that anyway. You'd still have to use something prior to the term itself.
But using them as is usually means that you don't have to use the brackets. And that's the, at least in my opinion, that's the motivation for using vocab in a lot of times.
Yeah, it's good to use the dot notation, absolutely, but I want to use the dot notation with the term from the vocabulary. And if I use schema.org, I want to use name and any other link relation or property that they have there as is after the dot. I wouldn't want to have like person.sc_name. I want to use just name. I think that's the primary difference between this and vocab.
Okay, yeah, that's another way to see it.
Yeah, I think for a certain subset of users, you're correct, Marcus. I do think there are other reasons that people use vocab. I mean, the main reason I think that vocab exists is for vocabularies like schema.org, these all gigantic Uber vocabularies where people want the data to look very, very clean, right? You're not doing a lot of vocabulary mixing. So I know that a couple of the folks from Google are interested in vocab because of that, because it makes the data look really, really clean, and there's no underscores or anything like that. They can just say vocab schema.org at the top and then start writing their data. So it's easy for people to kind of pick up. And, you know, I don't know if we can really make an argument about the primary reason that people are using a lot of these attributes, because it changes from application to application, right? So for example, you know, if we changed it to underscore, our company wouldn't use it still, because what we think our users are going to or the developers that are going to use the Paceworm stuff, what they're really going to want to use is dot notation, no underscores, you know, short and simple. So, you know, having to pick between a PS underscore asset and PS colon asset, we believe that the developers would just rather use dot asset to access the that value, right? Not dot ps underscore asset. So I still think that it's funny, because when we were talking, we've really switched our position on queries, at least internally in our company, over the past 4 or 5 years. Like, in the beginning, they were really cool and great in HTML and JSON, especially when you're mixing vocabularies. So they're great when you're generating, when you have to write code that has to be fairly correct, and you don't want to have to remember the URL. So they're great for compacting stuff like that in HTML. But when you actually go to work with the data, they're not awful, but there's a better way to work with the data, which is just use terms for everything. So I don't think changing the character would really help that class of people. But again, I don't know how large that class of people are. Right? I don't know how large the class of people are for each one of the arguments that we've made on the call. Anyway, sorry, Greg, you're on the queue.
Yeah. So I have some other uses where I will create terms. I actually added an annotation property to be able to say what term I want to use in the OWL definitions, and then I can construct a context from that. And the reason for that is not because of programmatic access. It's really sort of, as Mana was suggesting, because that's sort of what users want to expect for commonly used properties. I end up using OWL as a way to using restrictions to indicate properties that are expected to be present in a given object. Even though there might not be a strong cardinality. And for those types of things, I want to make it friendly to users that they're using, say, the name or the date properties of their objects without having to do schema name or schema date. So in that case, it's really a matter of sort of also having a distinguished set of properties that maybe come from multiple vocabularies, and that's really where terms come in handy. So, I guess with regards to that, I don't find the use of square brackets for things that I don't know about in advance to be problematic, and I'd suggest we just not do no change.
Okay, so let's get a proposal down here. And the proposal is going to be a positive proposal for a change to maybe demonstrate that it doesn't have, let me do the proposal as a do not change the prefix from a colon, do not change the prefix suffix separator from colon to
of course, it's also used so pervasively in other RDF syntaxes.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so there's the proposal.
Oops. Sorry, I did not mean to. Still early out here.
Should we try to do a proposal for a proposal introduce I don't know, a keyword sep to define an alias for the prefix?
I'd rather not.
No, I just want to see how many don't and how many do.
Okay, so yeah, we might as well do that. Let's see. Allow the prefix suffix separator to be aliased. I guess allow the prefix suffix separator to be aliased.
Yeah.
For example, plus sign in addition to colon. And Francois. All right. Oh, shit. That was not what I wanted to do. Anyway, I will put that in a minute.
It was a very powerful plus .5 there.
Right. Showing that Nicholas has far more voting power than any of us combined. Okay, 10:56. I don't think we're going to be able to address any of the other issues. Context and
coercion. We might want to go back to a slightly longer call format. I noticed the RDF working group does 75 minutes, which might be enough to get a little bit further in some things.
Yeah.
I was thinking if we're going to do that, we might as well just, you know, power through the issues and do a two-hour call if people are okay with it. I know that those are kind of marathon sessions, but we do tend to get a decent bit more done with the extra time. Is there any preference, 75 minutes or 90 minutes? My preference is 90 minutes. What do you guys think?
Yeah, mine as well.
Yeah. 90 is as well.
Okay.
It's better than 122, which I think might be too painful sometimes.
Yeah. Okay, so the next call, I guess, will be a two-hour call. And we'll keep doing the two-hour calls until we feel that we've got everything kind of...
Wait a second. We just asked if there's a preference for 75 or 90 minutes.
I'm sorry.
And Nicholas says better than 120 minutes. So.
Sorry, 90. What was it? 90 minutes.
90 minutes.
That's it. Oh, okay, okay. Sorry, I think I meant 120. My math is not working today.
One and a half hours, two hours. I still think 1.5. I mean, the last half hour we are usually kind of tired and just
dazed.
I don't
know. Okay, all right. So 90-minute calls then. And what we'll do is we'll start next week on those and keep doing 90-minute calls until we're through the issues, the major issues that we feel are required to take us through last call. Does that seem like a plan?
Yeah, I hope so.
Yes.
Okay. All right, great. Thanks for the call today, guys, and we'll chat next week and start our 90-minute calls. Have a great week. Talk to you guys next week.
Okay.